Lots of people used state capitalism as a swear word before Dunayevskaya, but she, with some assistance from C.L.R. James and a bit from Grace Lee, was the first to provide a factual and theoretical analysis that the USSR was state capitalist according to Marx's conception of capitalism. I say factual and theoretical analysis because this work involved a thorough and, I think, profound reinterpretation of Marx's Capital that radically diverged from standard interpretations. As Dunayevskaya wrote in Marxism and Freedom, quote, "Marxist textbooks for generation have repeated several truisms. In order that the society may be looked upon as capitalist, it seems essential to have this process of money in the pocket of the private capitalist, the buying of labor power, and means of production imperatives." Marx did not have to spend 40 years to prove that. My point is not that Marx had the USSR in mind when writing Capital. He had no knowledge of it and could not have anticipated it. Rather, he too got behind the forms of appearance to the essential relations. As Dunayevskaya puts it in one of the readings for today, quote, "Precisely because Marx analyzed a pure capitalist society which has never existed historically, his analysis holds true for every capitalist society, but only for capitalist society." Because he thought that their proposed alternatives to existing society wouldn't work. They would merely be capitalism in a different form, or they would be unviable and lead back to capitalism, because they all try to get rid of capitalism without getting rid of its mode of production. Thus, Marx was concerned to demonstrate both the primacy of production and the existence of a specifically capitalist mode of production. I think the basic defect in standard Marxian economics has been its failure to fully appreciate that there is a specifically capitalist mode of production. It regards production as trans-historical, common to all societies, and thus it distinguishes between different societies in terms of something else, their different property forms, or in terms of the differences in institutional forms through which production is regulated. For instance, the specificity of capitalism is said to be rooted in the fact that the distribution of labor, or more precisely, the allocation of resources and distribution of products and income, is regulated by market mechanisms and imperatives. Now, if that were the primary thing, then it would make perfect sense to try to get rid of capitalism by first changing these institutional forms. But if the institutional forms are themselves governed by the mode of production and correspond to them, and if a given society has institutional forms that differ from classical capitalism, but it has a specifically capitalist mode of production, then that society can be regarded as capitalist. That was the core of Dunayevskaya's argumentative strategy. It's wholly different from using state capitalism as a swear word or arguing the USSR was capitalist simply because it was exploitative or class society. There have been a wide variety of exploitative class societies. So something else, something distinct, must be present in order to regard the society as capitalist. But if there's a specifically capitalist mode of production, then that, rather than certain property forms or institutional forms that regulate production, can be the something else that's needed. Dunayevskaya didn't think state capitalism was the same as classical capitalism. She argued instead that the two of them were different from all prior social formations, but like one another by virtue of the specific mode of production they had in common. So what specifically is this specifically capitalist mode of production? I have time to mention only a few features. In prior societies, production was just production of concrete, useful products. In both forms of capitalism, though, private and state, it is also the production of abstract wealth or value, wealth that exists as a universal, not only in particular concrete forms. It's this abstract universal quality that allows it to be measured in terms of a universal equivalent, dollars, pounds sterling, rubles, etc. Moreover, the purpose of production isn't to produce consumer goods for the exploiters, as in prior societies, but to expand this abstract wealth. And while in prior societies production was limited because the consumption needs and wants of the exploiters was limited, how many houses can one person live in, how much food can he eat, now the production of wealth is potentially unlimited because of its abstract character. In one case, this drive toward unlimited wealth production appears as the individual's subjective aim of profit maximization. In the other case, it appeared as the objective social compulsion to catch up with and outdistance the private capitalist countries. In one case, the effect of the workers of this drive was Taylorism. In the other case, Stakhanovism. So there were differences. And in some contexts, they are important. But in essence, it's one and the same drive. Furthermore, because prior economies lacked this drive toward unlimited wealth, they were more or less no-growth economies, and economies without substantial increases in productivity. Private and state capitalism have, in contrast, grown rapidly and increased productivity rapidly. Frank Ferretti, in the book we have as a reading for today, strangely contends that the USSR was, quote, singularly unsuccessful in raising the productivity of labor. But he seems to be confusing lack of efficiency with lack of productivity growth. They're different things. Despite the very important inefficiency of the USSR's economy that Ferretti rightly highlights, its command economy, or what he calls the system of priority allocation, was pretty successful in achieving productivity growth. In fact, the USSR's productivity growth seems to have greatly outpaced that of the U.S. A pretty good proxy for labor productivity is real gross domestic product per person. Between 1928 and 1989, it rose by about 250% in the U.S., but 420%, much faster in the USSR. The other engine of growth in capitalism besides productivity growth is, as Marx's schemes of reproduction were the first to show, this other engine is the reallocation of means of production. A smaller share of the means of production, inputs, machines and stuff, go into the production of consumption goods and services. That allows a greater share of the means of production to go into the production of means of production, and thus means of production are reproduced at an expanded level. An investment of these additional means of production is what enables the economy to grow. Now, this unbalanced growth, the increase in means of production that outpaces the increase in production of articles of consumption, that was how growth took off in the classic case, the case of Britain. It's also how growth took off in Japan. And as Dunayevskaya's statistical analysis showed, it's how growth took off in the USSR. As Sir W. Arthur Lewis, the noted development economist, remarked in 1955, quote, "The British, the Japanese, and the Russian industrial revolutions all fit into the same pattern. In each case, the immediate result is that the benefits..." Anyway, W. Arthur Lewis, "The British, the Japanese, and the Russian industrial revolutions all fit into the same pattern," he said. "In each case, the immediate result is that the benefits of rising productivity do not go to peasants and wage earners, but into further capital formation." Okay, today's meeting came about as a result of Tim's question during MHI's annual conference about the theory of state capitalism in contrast to Hillel Tikhtin's theory of what the USSR was. I don't want to say much about Tikhtin, but instead focus on the theory put forward in Frank Ferretti's 1986 book, The Soviet Union Demystified, partly because it's more familiar to many of the participants in today's meeting, but also because it is similar to Tikhtin, as Marcel van der Linden notes in his recent book, Western Marxism and the Soviet Union, quote, "Ferretti's analysis of the Soviet Union was, to a large extent, inspired by the work of Hillel Tikhtin, But while Tickton's work remained fragmentary, Ferrady offered an ambitious synthesis which tried to integrate Tickton's empirical observations about waste, class, and so forth. But there are some differences between them. For instance, I noted at the annual conference that Tickton argues that the USSR wasn't capitalist by pointing to characteristic institutional features of capitalism that were absent in the USSR. And I remarked that this is like arguing that since human beings are a bipedal animal, someone who has lost a leg or both legs must not be a human being. Now, Ferrady's theory does not have this problem. In dismissing the idea that the USSR was capitalist, Ferrady does not appeal to a laundry list of features. It focuses pretty exclusively on a single claim, the claim that the Soviet bureaucracy, quote, destroyed the operation of the law of value. Note especially that Ferrady does not appeal to some other common arguments against the idea that the USSR was state capitalist. He doesn't say that nationalization of property makes a society not capitalist. He notes that, quote, neither Marx nor Lenin regarded nationalization itself as progressive, and except insofar as it enhances socialization of labor and increases productivity, quote, nationalized property has no special significance, Ferrady says. Nor does he argue that the USSR was a planned economy. He and Dunayskaya are in agreement that it was not. For instance, she argued that, quote, it has become absolutely impossible for Stalin Incorporated to guide the productive system without sudden stagnation and crises due to the constant necessity of adjusting the individual components of total capital to one another into the world market. And she said that what was called planning was merely the statified instead of the spontaneous submission to the laws of motion of capitalist production. Similarly, Ferrady contends that what was called planning was, quote, really an administrative response to forces which remained outside the bureaucracy's control, and often a, quote, pragmatic adaptation to the forces of spontaneity. So as I said, Ferrady's view that the USSR wasn't capitalist instead boils down to the claim that the law of value didn't operate there. What I want to say now is that this claim actually isn't empirical. No facts about the USSR are in dispute here. Instead, everything depends on his definitions of the terms. He implicitly defines capitalism as a society in which the law of value operates, and implicitly defines operation of the law of value as regulation of the economy through market mechanisms. If one accepts both of these definitions, then it follows that the USSR wasn't capitalist because the law of value didn't operate there. But if one doesn't accept the definitions, then all that is left is a commonplace observation, which isn't in dispute, the observation that the USSR didn't have a market economy. I personally have no problem with defining capitalism as a society in which the law of value operates, nor did Dunayskaya have a problem with it. Indeed, this is precisely why she regarded the 1943 Russian Stalinist article that recognized that the law of value operated in the USSR. Okay, she saw that as a tacit admission that its economy was capitalist according to a Marxian understanding of capitalism and according to the Stalinist own past doctrine. Okay, it was all based on the recognition that the law of value is capitalist and operates under their society as well. So my problem is with Ferrady's definition of the operation of the law of value as regulation of the economy through market mechanisms. As Dunayskaya might have said, this is true, but it is not the whole truth. Marx did not have to spend 40 years to prove that. Ferrady's definition evidently derives from two sources. One is the work of Evgeny Preobrazhensky, a Bolshevik and member of the left opposition of the 1920s, work which Ferrady greatly admires. The other source is a paragraph in a letter Marx wrote to a friend, Ludwig Kugelmann. Ferrady basically just repeats Preobrazhensky's understanding of the law of value, according to which it's essentially the same thing as the so-called law of supply and demand. It operates to the extent that prices, levels of output, allocation of resources and workers are determined by competition and markets, and it operates only to that extent. As Ferretti puts it, quote, under capitalism, products are produced for the market. The so-called law of supply and demand regulates the distribution of labor time and the products of labor. But when operation of the law of value is defined in this narrow way, there's an obvious problem with defining capitalism as a society in which the law of value operates. The problem is that capitalism no longer really exists anywhere, according to this definition. What we have are instead, at most, mixed economies. Okay, so to recap where I was, briefly, Frank Ferretti basically defines capitalism as a economy in which the law of value operates. And he defines the law of value as the regulation of the economy through market mechanisms. And I was saying that when the operation of the law of value is defined in this narrow way, there's an obvious problem then when you say that capitalism is a society in which the law of value operates. And the problem is that capitalism no longer really exists anywhere. What we have are instead at most mixed economies, so-called. As Preobrazhensky recognized, quote, in the monopolistic period of capitalism, the law of value has already been partially abolished, according to his definition of law of value, owing to the powerful development of monopoly tendencies in present-day capitalism. He wrote, quote, when there is trustification of important branches of production, prices systematically deviate from value in the upward direction, and therefore economic necessity imposes itself in a way which is significantly different from what happens under the law of value. And Preobrazhensky even argued that in Germany during World War I, quote, the working of the law of value in many respects was almost completely replaced by the planning principle of state capitalism. Now, the undermining of the law of value, as Preobrazhensky defined it, didn't pose a big problem for him because he recognized that there could still be capitalism, forms of capitalism in which the law of value was partly or totally inoperative. Monopoly capitalism and state capitalism. But it poses a big problem for Ferretti, who implicitly defines capitalism as a society governed by the law of value. As I said, he has defined it out of existence. Now, as for Marx's letter to Kugelmann, what Marx wrote was, quote, the necessity of the distribution of social labor in definite proportions cannot possibly be done away with. And the form in which this proportional distribution cannot possibly be done away with. What can change in historically different circumstances is only the form. And the form in which this proportional distribution of labor asserts itself in the state of society where the interconnection of social labor is manifested in the private exchange of the individual products of labor is precisely the exchange value of these products. Okay? Now, Ferretti takes this as a definition of the law of value. But that's more than a bit of a stretch. Marx doesn't even use the term law of value or any synonym for it here. So he's certainly not putting forward a definition of the term. Ferretti ignores the many places in which Marx does use the term law of value and synonyms such as the determination of value by labor time. It doesn't take much work to see that the meaning of these terms as employed by Marx cannot be reduced to the distribution of labor time through the mechanism of the market. For instance, in chapter 10 of the third volume of Capital, Marx wrote, quote, no matter how the prices are regulated, we arrive at the following. One, the law of value dominates price movements. Two, since the total value of the commodities regulates the total surplus value, and this in turn regulates the level of average profit and thereby the general rate of profit, it follows that the law of value regulates the prices of production. Later in the same volume, Marx reiterated that, quote, the law of value is not affected by the precise manner in which prices of particular commodities are determined. The law is not affected by prices, the existence of prices that aren't determined by market competition. For instance, monopoly prices and state-regulated prices. Because Such change in the way that prices are determined, quote, does not abolish surplus value itself, nor the total value of commodities as the source of the various price components. So as Marx is using the term law of value, the question of whether this law does or doesn't operate has nothing to do with prices determined in competitive markets. What matters is whether the products are commodities, things that aren't only useful but possess so-called value, and whether the total value of all the commodities taken together is determined by the amount of labor needed to produce them. If so, then the law of value, as Marx is using the term, is operative. Now, Frey realizes that his position concerning the law of value contradicts Stalin's own contention that the law of value operated in the USSR. He tries to dismiss Stalin's claim. He argues, quote, that Stalin's, quote, equation of the law of value with socialism may be dismissed as no more than an apology for the state of affairs in the USSR, in the Soviet Union. Frey continues, what he, Stalin, called not a bad thing, the law of value, was simply the unconscious and capricious operation of market forces, close quote. That's on page 91 of Frey's book. Now, in response to the 1943 Russian revision of the law of value, Dunayevskaya similarly said that it was an apology for the actual state of affairs in the Soviet Union, quote, a theoretical justification of social distinctions enshrined in the Soviet Constitution. And she wrote that this departure of past teaching of political economy actually mirrors economic reality. Instead of theory, the article presents an administrative formula for minimum costs and maximum production. Yet Dunayevskaya and the Russians both drew the obvious conclusion that Ferretti shies away from. The conclusion is that the actual state of affairs in the USSR was the operation of the law of value. Now, although Ferretti shies away from this conclusion, he concedes that, quote, the unconscious and capricious operation of market forces compelled managers in the U.S., in the USSR, to, in Stalin's words, conduct production on rational lines, improve methods of production, lower production costs, and make their enterprises pay. In other words, it compelled them to act just like the managers we know and love, managers of private companies. Stalin held correctly that such behavior is a consequence of the operation of the law of value. And Ferretti also concedes that, quote, unless conscious regulation is established, then despite the elimination of the market, the forces of spontaneity will continue to wreak havoc. Now, this is rather strange. If there was unconscious and capricious operation of market forces, despite the elimination of the market, if the forces of spontaneity continue to wreak havoc, how can one maintain that the law of value didn't continue to operate? Just what are these forces of spontaneity? In Chapter 1 of Capital, Marx described what we could call the forces of spontaneity precisely in terms of the operation of the law of value. Quote, the labor time socially necessary to produce commodities asserts itself as a regulative law of nature in the same way that the law of gravity asserts itself when a person's house collapses on top of them. The determination of the magnitude of value by labor time is therefore a secret hidden under the apparent movements in the relative values of commodities. Why doesn't Ferretti recognize this? Again, it's because of the very narrow way he defines law of value, such that the law operates only to the extent that distribution and allocation of resources are determined through competitive markets. If the determination of value by socially necessary labor time produces its unplanned, spontaneous consequences in a somewhat different way because of the absence of competitive markets, then on Ferretti's definition, the law of value didn't operate. What's at issue here is whether an economic law, or indeed a physical law, can have only one form of manifestation, or whether it can manifest itself in different ways. If the law of gravity doesn't assert itself by causing a person's house to collapse on top of him, but instead it makes the foundation of the house give way, does the law of gravity fail to operate? Or does it merely manifest itself in a somewhat different form? Okay, I want to end where Fourierdy begins, on Marx's conception of the path from capitalism to communism. I was rather shocked by what Fourierdy wrote about this. I've read similar things before, but I'm always shocked. Fourierdy argues that Marx held that class differences will persist in the lower phase of communism, and that the working class will, quote, ensure its political control over society through the dictatorship of the proletariat in the lower phase. Now, if class differences persist, just what are we fighting for? Only, quote, the steady growth of the productive forces, close quote, and the political power that Fourierdy tells us the proletarian dictatorship must ensure? In any case, far from holding that class differences persist in the lower phase of communism, Marx wrote explicitly in his critique of the Gotha program that there are, quote, no class differences, because everyone is only a worker like everyone else, close quote. The problem is that Fourierdy has confused and conflated Marx's notion of a political transition period between capitalist and communist societies with the lower phase of communist society. Okay, what Marx wrote was, quote, between capitalist and communist society lies a political transition period in which the state can be nothing but the revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat. But within communist society itself, including its lower phase, there aren't any class differences, in Marx's account, nor any need for a state in the proper sense, since everyone is only a worker like everyone else. By conflating the political transition period between capitalist and communist societies with the lower phase of communist society, Fourierdy transforms the lower phase into a non-communist society, a merely transitional society between capitalism and communism. Is that what we're fighting for? A society in which classes and the state persist instead of a classless, stateless society? In Marx's account, in contrast, there's no transitional society, just a political transition period that accompanies the revolutionary transformation of capitalist society into communist society. In other words, there's no in-between society that's neither fish nor fowl. Fourierdy goes so far as to rule out the possibility of equality in the lower phase of communism on the grounds that, quote, the material foundations for equality won't be complete. That clearly departs from Marx's view. Marx held explicitly in the critique that there will be, quote, equal right, close quote, in the lower phase of communism. Yeah, those who work more will have more income, but given equal performance of labor, one will be entitled to what Marx called an equal share in the social consumption fund. In other words, those who work the same amount will be entitled to the same income. That's equality. Underlying these revisions of Marx's text, I think, is Fourierdy's belief that we can't have a communist society in the here and now. A period of transition, he writes, is, quote, needed to build up the material prerequisites for communist society. And he writes, quote, until humanity has overcome want, classes will persist, close quote. In other words, until productivity has increased to the point where the distributive principle is from each according to his ability to each according to his needs, then Fourierdy thinks that we're doomed to live under state repression, endure inequality, and toil within class society, all for the sake of building up the productive forces. That's the end.
Thank you. Firstly, thank you to Andrew for the presentation and responding to my original concerns about, if you like, the value of the state capitalist in theory, where it's what its status is. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to make a small number of points. If I'm going on or drifting off topic, feel free to interrupt. Firstly, a declaration of interest. Although I played no major theoretical role, I was a party to the whole process in the writing of this book, the Frank Fourierdy Soviet Union Demystified, in the sense that the drafts of each chapter, as they were developed by Frank and the other people doing the research and collaborating, were discussed in conference over a significant period of time, which I was party to, as far as I know, almost all of the major plenary discussions and some of the minor ones. And I also helped design the book. So I have a working familiarity with it. I have been very ill over Christmas. I haven't done as much preparation and background reading, particularly on Dunaskaya's original research in this area, to be able to be fully conversant with some of the points that I feel I'm still wrestling with. But firstly, thank you for the discussion. For me, it's still an outstanding issue, and I still share and hold many of the arguments in this book, and would like to be able to respond to some of the ways that Andrew has presented this. But there's no major issue here. I'm not a working economist. I can't hold figures in the course of a discussion in my head to use empirical examples and things. So I may be accused of just trying to paint a picture in a broad brush sense. But for me, and knowing some of the previous documents, because the RCP had a fairly thoroughgoing criticism of the state capitalist formulation and where it had come from historically out of our reading of Bernstein's critique of Marx's theory of crisis and the possibilities of state reformist state socialism through Hilferding's work, which extended that. We saw state capital not as a swear word, but actually representing broadly the view potentially of an individual capitalist or the revisionists within the labour movement and you know, traditionally it's Stalinists within the Marxist movement who had developed quite a substantial theory of state monopoly capitalism, which shares a lot of ground with this. So if I can wrap up my concerns here, I still find a problem here in that I'm very warmly appreciative of the quite a large range of now what I've read of Dunaskaya's analysis. I still have an abiding problem with this formulation. And it may be just my lack of comprehensive reading, I still haven't found the, if you like, the theoretical and analytical roots of her argument that the Soviet Union was capitalist and that there was a law of value operating. I take Andrew's point about Frank defining it more in categorical terminology than any empirical data. But I have to say that I had already travelled to the Soviet Union, specifically looking at this from a point of view of the designers in the Soviet Union trying to raise the level of productivity. I was an extramural student of R.W. Davis and the team at the Center for Russian and East European Studies in Birmingham, which were looking specifically at the dynamics of science and technology in the Soviet Union, who I had quite a lot of contact with before I went there in 1980. And they and we and subsequently Tikhtin and Faraday were all wrestling with the problem of the problem that the Soviet Union had of a negative return on investment, and I would still argue with a failure to systematically raise productivity. And the remaining question, I suppose, which is the test question, is if the Soviet Union was truly capitalist and operating to the law of value, why did, after the Zanavskaya report and Gorbachev's initiatives. Why did there have to be a formal reinstitution of capitalism and the law of value over the previous regime if it had already been operating? We obviously argued that it should have gone in the direction of a turn towards full workers' control as being the only other option. So I'm going to stop there because I may maybe not doing my own argument justice, but thanks for listening.
Let's now hear from Chris.
And after that, I'd like to speak, Ravi.
Okay. Chris, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, it's a question really about productivity, because I'm not clear on the question of productivity in some of the work by Dunevskaya about whether increase in productivity of labour is a good thing, right? So it seems to me that if we want to, as Marx puts it in the German ideology, fish in the morning, paint in the afternoon, whatever, then we would need to, labour would need to be more productive, which does then mean that you would have a higher organic composition of capital. Whereas that doesn't seem to be, or there seems to be ambivalence or contradictions on that count in some of the material I read. That may be my skim reading of it, rather than a problem with the material itself, but I'd just like some clarification on that. The second question I've got really is something that Andrew raised in his introduction, where he said that, and maybe I misheard this, that Dunayevskaya re-read or Capital was politically motivated to do that by the existence of the Soviet Union. And so what I'm really asking is, okay, I can understand in terms of as changes happen, like when you have revisionism in the Second International and Lenin wants to find out what's the basis of this revisionism, where are they going wrong in terms of Marx, and going back to read Hegel. Are you saying that that's what happens, or that's what motivated Dunayevskaya to go back and look at Capital? Because it almost sounds like you were saying Dunayevskaya reinterpreted Capital. Over.
Hi, it's Ravi. Shall I chime in now?
Yes, I'm sorry. I forgot to unmute myself to call on you. Go ahead, Ravi.
I think the key thing that comes out of Andrew's introduction, and it's there in the Dunevskaya readings as well, is the treatment of the working class, of labour, and the way in which it's regarded. So the defining feature of capitalism really is the existence of abstract labour, the fact that workers are held to an abstract standard that is to do with socially how long it takes to complete a certain type of work, and that's abstractly set by a standard of socially necessary labour time. And as long as the contribution of the individual worker is not seen as a specific concrete one that is there to satisfy a need through a technical form of production to meet that need, and as long as it's measured by an abstract social standard of socially necessary labour time in terms of how much should be completed in this given time, then that is abstract labour. It is labour that is regulated by a standard that is imposed by the production level across society, and it takes no account of the worker as an individual. And I think that as the kind of dominant theme as to what makes capitalism what it is, its treatment of workers and that existence of workers as an abstract category in which they're regulated by an external force to achieve something that is not of their own sort of decision and volition. That is essentially what is being described by Marx and is picked up on by Dinashkaran and is now kind of hammered home by Andrew. I think as soon as you grasp that, you can see everything that's wrong with the Soviet Union demystified is that it's not focusing on labour as a process and what it means to be a worker under capitalism. It is instead looking at external features about how surplus is appropriated in the forms by which capitalism regulates itself. And in that sense, the whole thing of like mixed economies that Andrew mentioned, you can see that in all kinds of different forms of capitalism, you've got different ways of appropriating what is produced and the way in which that's distributed. But the essential thing is the existence of abstract labour in the first place. And without that, you're not going to get why state capitalism makes more sense of the Soviet Union than Frank did, unfortunately. Whatever the intentions were, I don't think it did it in the spirit that Marx did it. And I mean, that's shown by the readings that we got from Dinashkaran, particularly the one on the nature of the Soviet state and that revision of Marxian theory or economics, whatever it is, that's taught in the Soviet Union. Both of those show very clearly why her approach made much more sense of sort of Marx's attitude to capitalism than Frank did. Okay, over.
This is Brendan. Can I be placed on stack?
Yes, you're on stack. Let me just see if Andrew wants to respond to anything yet or wait for more.
I do, but I mean, it's the prerogative of the chair or the body whether I get to respond or whether we hear everybody.
Well, we've had a three, so I don't know what to do. Let's have Brendan, and then we'll let Andrew get in a word. Okay, Brendan, you want to go ahead?
Yes, I'll be brief. Thank you. I just wanted to respond to the comment. I'm not sure if I'm getting names already, but the question about the organic composition of capital as Dunayevskaya treats it, and whether she has some sort of ambivalence as to whether a socialist society is to develop the productive forces or the productivity of labor. I guess it's hard to have that, you know, a specific without talking about a specific passage, it's hard to be really, I guess, specific about what Dunayevskaya might be implying in certain places. But my understanding of difference between a capitalist society and a socialist society or a communist society from my reading of Dunayevskaya would be that, well, for one, it's really problematic to treat the idea of the productivity of labor abstractly without the context of sort of the things that Ravi was saying, the context of the relationship of the labor process itself. You know, in a capitalist society, the labor process is, or the labor becomes more productive purely in a way that is meant to use the increased productivity of labor as a weapon against labor. So the organic composition of capital as it grows is a process of the worker losing control of her own work and the domination of debt over living labor, of machines over people, of capital over labor. And in a socialist society, it would be the opposite case, right? That the increased productivity of labor would be a way to liberate labor from unwanted work and make the labor process a fulfilling experience. Unless sort of, you know, references from the Critique of the Gotha program that the speaker a couple of people ago mentioned. And I think what Dunayevskaya is trying to get at is what essentially is that difference in the mode of production that would make an increased productivity of labor such a completely different experience. In the Soviet Union, the increased productivity of labor was not something that liberated people, that made work more meaningful or better the individual worker at all was a tool for controlling people and increasing the surplus value accrued to capital or to the capitalist class. So obviously there was something different about the mode of production itself that made that question of productivity so radically different between that and Marx's vision of labor in a communist society. Over.
Andrew, you want the floor now?
Sure. I'll try to deal with what everybody's said, starting with Tim, who asked about the theoretical and analytical roots of Dunayevskaya's theory that the USSR was state capitalist. I don't know whether you mean roots in terms of antecedents, because there really are not antecedents. But the content, the theoretical and analytical content, is partly in the work Nature of the Russian Economy that was a reading for today. What was really part of the same work but went unpublished because the Shachmanites refused to publish the part that we read. They published the statistical analysis of the five-year plans that she undertook. That's called an analysis of the Russian economy. There are lots of theoretical pieces, including the comment she made in the American Economic Review in response to the Russian revision of the law of value. Then there's a rejoinder also in the American Economic Review the following year to a lot of criticism she got from Paul Baran and Leo Rogan and other people like that. There are many other documents that were unpublished. I'm working on the editing of a book that's going to put all these, not all of them, put a large number of them together. So it's not like they were in one place and codified in a book. She kind of wrote the way Lenin typically wrote in the heat of battle. So it takes some work to get the whole picture. But what I tried to do in the beginning of my presentation was to give the methodology of this, because I think in the end it boils down to I really do think it boils down to rooting oneself in Marx's Capital with a view to the essential relations rather than the forms of appearance. And like I said, I didn't see, apart from the strange comment about the USSR failing to, being singularly unsuccessful in increasing productivity, apart from that rather peculiar comment, I didn't see anything really to question in what Ferretti said factually. So it's all a question of what do the facts mean. And so, Tim, you're just going to have to read some more, I think, to answer your own question. And Tim said something else regarding the failure to raise productivity in the USSR that I didn't quite get. Tim, could you repeat that?
Broadly speaking, what I was trying to drive at was that not just my, but a number of perceptions of the economy, and I'm talking about the 70s and early 80s, was that there was a complete autarky within the Soviet economy. There was double bookkeeping. There was local bookkeeping of real employment and use of resources, and then there was, if you like, completely fictitious documents going up for state central planning, overstating the requirements in the hope that the completely broken internal systems of distribution of resources would actually, if they were completely over budgeted, could come up with the results to keep things going. And that's, there were so many both anecdotes and case studies of that, if you like, a completely broken internal system, which I found at the time made Faraday's analysis very persuasive. A question that arises, perhaps as a test point, is in Dunaskaya's estimation, I acknowledge I'm still reading this material and I'm still very much a student of the ideas here. At what point, for how long was the Soviet Union able to break the hold of the theory of value, if it did, and in what time frame and by what processes did the theory of value reassert itself to give the a real basis for her characterization of the Soviet economy to be a capitalist one? One of the questions that hasn't arisen here, and a question that I haven't got the ability to pin down precisely, is the whole question of the nature of the state. Because in my understanding, it's theoretically impossible for capitalism to function if there is a comprehensive centralization and concentration to the point of view theoretically there is only one capitalist. The whole generalization of the rate of profit depends on a competition between capitals, in my view. And so there are theoretic problems there, and that opens a whole series of questions about the perception of the nature of the state, which I actually think are the roots of my reservations in some of these arguments. Anyway, over.
Okay, thanks for the clarification. I'm going to be brief regarding some of these additional questions because you've gotten two shots and other people just got one. But I now understand the point about productivity. It's very true that managers of enterprises hoarded resources in the USSR. But that is not a point about productivity as such. That is a point, again, about efficiency. Okay, the resources were not being allocated efficiently. They were being hoarded. That's not a question of productivity. Now, clearly, you would have more productivity if you had more efficiency. So there's a relationship. But efficiency is a static concept. It's given what you have right now, are you utilizing it in the optimal way? The workers, means of production, etc. Productivity growth is a dynamic concept. It refers to what's happening over time. And yes, as I said, efficiency, lack of efficiency limits productivity growth, but despite that, the USSR was successful in raising productivity, the amount of output per worker, or the amount of output per worker hour. The facts are really incontrovertible, given the magnitude of the increase between 1928 and 1989 in real GDP, gross domestic product per worker. My statistics are not coming, you know, just straight from reported statistics, Soviet statistics. They're coming from the late Angus Madison, who, you know, was very careful to do his own estimates of kind of like everything, and who wrote papers on the problems of the USSR's data. I spent some time looking for, you know, something directly on labor productivity, you know, a consistent series. I couldn't find it. But if you have a, you know, according to what I computed from Madison, a 419% increase between 1928 and 1989 in real gross domestic product per person, you have to have had significant increases in labor productivity, which is gross domestic product per labor hour. I mean, keep in mind that Russia was a really backward country as of 1928. It was still, you know, it was emerging from being really just like a semi-feudal country. Then it got destroyed by the war. Okay, but less than 40 years later, they put Sputnik up in space. You know, something happened, and that something wasn't efficient, but what it was, and Fouretti describes it well, is, you know, priority allocation. We're going to build up science, we're going to build up heavy industry, and, you know, let everything else go to rot, because we have our priorities, which are to catch up with and outdistance the capitalist lands. So why was the law of value formally reinstituted under Gorbachev? Well, it was formally reinstituted in 1943 already under Stalin. What happened, you know, in the start of the 1990s, to me, that is very good prima facie evidence that there was no fundamental change in the class nature of the economy. I mean, not a shot was fired. And the state bureaucrats of a supposedly non-capitalist country become, you know, basically they and their friends become, you know, private capitalists of a private capitalist country overnight without firing a shot. How can that happen if there was some fundamental discontinuity between these two societies? I think that what happened is the error of, you know, let's just expand everything through, you know, these massive inefficient programs of building up things, that you know, Russia was now an advanced economy to a large extent. And at that point, they wanted greater efficiency. You know, the same thing happened in Britain. I mean, it wasn't a very efficient economy. You know, the Industrial Revolution, they did everything to build up the economy. Then they worried about efficiency. I think the same thing started to happen in Russia, and that had something to do with the political change. When did the law of value get reinstated in the USSR? I don't think it ever was not reinstated. I mean, you had a period of war after the October Revolution, and then what you have is the NEP, which clearly is just a recognition of the strong presence of the law of value. Regarding the theory of the state and the competition among capitals, Dunayevskaya said in no uncertain terms that there could not be a system worldwide where there was one single capital. You have to have competition of capitals. The question is whether a national capital can function as one of those capitals in a system of world competition, whether that's competition for, you know, market shares and profits in the market, or competition for world domination. That's also a form of competition. It's a different form. It makes the laws of capitalist production, the law of value, etc., function in a different way. But again, that doesn't mean that they don't function at all. They just function differently. So I don't personally see a problem there, but I don't know. You didn't really spell out what you meant by problems having to do with the nature of the state. Regarding Chris's question regarding productivity, whether it's a good increasing it is a good thing, Dunayevskaya seems ambivalent.
I agree with what Brendan said. What seems to be ambivalence on Dunayevskaya's part is really a class perspective. There's no neutral development of productivity. You know, it's always either, you know, that of a classless society, or it's that of one class dominating the other. And I think we have to have different attitudes to that. Now, I mean, look, Marx said the historical mission of the bourgeoisie was to increase productivity, production for production's sake, accumulation for accumulation's sake, and that was historically progressive at one time. It could not have been otherwise. You know, the conditions for freedom were not there without that buildup of productivity. But we're not at that point anymore. And so the question is really, can we have a continuing increase in productivity of an entirely different sort in the kind of way that that Brendan was outlining? So it's not a question of productivity growth versus not productivity growth. It's a question of whether we need to, you know, toil through these alleged transitional societies and forsake freedom and forsake equality and forsake, you know, classlessness in order to build up these productive forces as a precondition for freedom, or whether we can have it now. I just want to read something. The paragraph might be familiar to many of you. This is from the third volume of Capital. Marx is talking about the fall in the rate of profit. Quote, "The true barrier to capitalist production is capital itself. It's that capital and its self-valorization appear as the starting and finishing point, as the motive and purpose of production. Production is only production for capital, and not the reverse. The means of production are not simply means for a steadily expanding pattern of life for the society of the producers." And that's the true barrier. So, I mean, I think that's the question, is what function do the means of production play? Are they simply means for a steadily expanding pattern of life for the society of the producers, or aren't they? And if you are industrializing by, you know, trimming the workers' living standards in order to build up heavy industry, that's not the case. And that's the historic problem, in my view. I didn't fully understand what you were saying, Chris, about Dunayevskaya rereading Capital and political motivation. You said it sounded, from what I was saying, that she reinterpreted Capital. Well, I said very definitely that she reinterpreted Capital. What does that mean, reinterpreted? It means her interpretation was significantly different than the received interpretations. I kind of think that some really, you know, strong motivation like that is needed to get at things. And I think that your comment about the World War One and Lenin going back to Hegel is kind of reflective of that. If you just read, you know, oh, I'm going to read this person, you're just reading without knowing what you're looking for. And when you read without knowing what you're looking for, you don't really make much use of it. You know, it's about you, and it's not about here, I'm going to do something, and I'm here to work with these ideas and concepts. But when you've got a clear purpose, like a purpose that's driven by politics, you don't just read in that kind of semi-passive way. You're looking to do. And there's a sharpness of the reading that I think comes from that. But I'm not sure I fully understood your question. I agree with what Ravi said about Ferretti not focusing on what it means to be a worker under capitalism, and I didn't say too much about that either, partly because it would just be more mediations to get to that point, given that he didn't talk about it and so forth. Yeah, I mean, the existence of abstract labor, abstract wealth or value, I think all of that is very crucial. And I didn't mention it, but I think that Ferretti is among those who I criticized who
really views production kind of transhistorically. At least the evidence from the book is, you know, there's just production, and that takes place in all societies, and what differs is the institutional mechanisms and imperatives that that regulate that.
Okay. Is there more discussion from other people who haven't yet been heard?
This is Stephanie. I have something that just came to mind from what Andrew said about how to read stuff and what motivates people. I don't know if it's appropriate to say it at this point or maybe later on. What came to mind, and it's a summary of sort of people using words and how phrases and concepts are used. So I can hold this.
No, Stephanie, go ahead now because we're not going to have a lot more time. So whatever you want to say, put on the table.
Okay. So I like what Andrew just said about reading, you know, reading things, why we read or choose to, you know, look at a resource, whatever that resource is, you know, a lecture or reading or discussion or something, that we come to it not just sort of passively, hopefully, but in under, you know, different circumstances at different times in a person's life or in history, that we're motivated because we want to do something with what, you know, what we're reading or discussing. And I guess having read the minimum amount of Dunayevskaya's work, but the amounts of Dunayevskaya's work that I've been asked to over the couple of years that I've been communicating MHI folks, I think I'm getting a gut level understanding of where she was at, better than I had before, and I was really impressed with how clear this article, The Nature of the Russian Economy, was to understand. I think I like what you know, the idea of not using the phrase or the term state capitalism as a swear word. That's humorous in a way, but it's also very important. And I just, even simple concepts like efficiency of production, how that's different from productivity growth. I had no framework for understanding that those things were different until I heard what Andrew said today. And these are it feels as if almost half the time, even very well-educated and astute people that have been using these terms for a long time are like, it's like missing cues from one another. People have either, because they've used certain terms and identified concepts in certain ways for a very long time, they hold on to that. We hold on to these things if we have them to begin with. And then we're not communicating when we use them, or we're communicating sort of in parallel worlds. And I think it's really important, especially if we're going to try to do something with discussion. And when I say we, I don't mean just us here today, but in general in the world of revolution and moving society from where it is now globally, you know, across the world, that we need to somehow communicate what we mean by certain terms, and I don't know, come to consensus about the terms in a useful way, not necessarily in a solely academic or you know, removed from reality way. Okay, so I'll just stop there and see where that goes. Over.
Nigel would like to speak.
Okay, Nigel, go ahead.
Okay, sorry, can you hear me? Over.
Yeah, Nigel, can you hear me?
Okay, yes, okay.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. thanks for the conference. It's very interesting. I was thinking about the incoherence of society. I've been very, very interested in one of the things I've started, well, before I come across MHI, was that a lot of the left's defining what they're aiming for in completely different ways, and it's sort of a strange incoherence or lack of understanding of what they got to do to get it, and especially over this whole.
Hold on a second, Nigel, because you're very blurry. You may be too close to your microphone, or...
Am I okay now?
Try again.
Testing. As I was saying, I'll repeat what I was saying. Okay. As I was saying before, just now, when I came across MA, before I came across, I was very interested in Lex. In different left groups had, in terms of their ideas towards what they want, which is, they all seem to have different approaches, etc.
Hold on a second, Nigel, I'm sorry, but you're like breaking up and staticky. Now you're in the same place as Floyd and Ravi, right?
Yes,
so, that's right. So it's something you're doing different.
What if I come forward? Is that better?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it's probably that. That's what it is then. Okay. Sorry. So my point is that I was interested in the way that left approaches what they want, what they're aiming for, and what communist society is, and the interestingly, and what the idea of transition is. And I like that essay, the incoherence of the transition society, a lot. But especially, and you know, I get that, especially the bit where it starts talking about the difference between transition and transformation into a mode of production, and the way that the tradition looks at the whole thing as a case of, like, you get people excited about certain ideas. You know, you go into elections or something, you win power in elections and you form a mass party and basically leave the mode of production intact, which is what happens, for example, in Greece, which is why lots of people have been disappointed that socialism didn't happen. But the thing is that, you know, so that was very interesting, that unintended consequences that from that essay. But it seems to imply that your MHI seems to imply. Hello? Hello?
Yes.
I think it's cut off.
Something did, yeah.
Yeah, it just cut off.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. There you go. Sorry. Okay, so you're criticizing unintended consequences, the way that the death approaches seizure of power, etc. So I'm interested in something that's implied, but not quite gone into, in that you must have a different concept in some way, in regards to this whole thing about political organisation, the way you approach the working class, and you know, the whole concept of seizing power. And listening to the conference recently, would you really, so for you, a lot of people, I used to be part of the Vanguard Party as well, and this whole idea of seizing power and dictatorship is a big thing of the proletariat. You seem to be implying that the dictatorship of the proletariat is something else. It's almost like, is it, from what I think, is the, that you would say to the red class, the thing to do would be the seizure of the means of production, rather than some kind of generalized, activity where you tell people seize the means of production as a way of beginning the process of the transformation in the mode of production. That's what I'm interested in, is how you see the mode of production being transformed, which is which everybody in the left is very interested in. they've all got, at the moment, in advanced capitalist countries, it's the parliamentary way we get and maintain a massive party, like you've seen unintended consequences, and somehow you seize power and things change then. So what is it that you would, you know, that MHI sees as the first steps in a revolutionary movement or the seizing of power? Over.
I'll say a few words. Oh, Aisling, is that you?
Yes.
Do you want to speak?
Yes, that's okay.
Yeah, okay, you go and then I'll go, and then we'll have to evaluate the time problems. Go ahead.
Okay. I think my question's more about trying to understand some of the features of a communist society. It's a question from the readings that I've done. It's kind of, how do we ensure that transition is a necessary phase of the transformation of society? How do we ensure this doesn't become an end in itself? The dictatorship of the proletariat, you know, I understand surely must be a particular form of social organisation within a broader period of transition. That is, that it's not an objective, but an observable phase en route to a form of workers' management. But if it's not guided by the market, if it's not guided by planning, it seems to be a bit too abstract for me, the idea that it's guided by a collective need. It seems a bit too abstract. And the readings I have found fascinating for kind of picking apart for me what was problematic and understanding those more clearly, what was problematic specifically in the USSR. But I'm left with a bit of a blank about what would be a more effective way to ensure that mistakes that we can observe don't, you know, aren't made. Like I say, if it's not guided by the market, if it's not guided by planning, the idea that it's guided by need, I can't see how that actually comes about, how that actually operates. Maybe my understanding or my inability to understand that is a bit restricted by the fact that I can't kind of see beyond, you know, what is my own experience of the features of how society is organised now. So I'd appreciate some kind of comment on that that would enable me to take my understanding beyond its limits.
All right, Andrew wants the floor.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it to him.
You don't have to.
Well, go ahead, then I'll go.
Okay. Oh, you go. I'm sorry. I forgot that you wanted to go.
Yeah. We've touched on so many things, I'm not even sure what to talk about, but I think both Nigel and Aisling had some good points about, you know, what do we want to do with this knowledge, and how can we prevent just one after another revolution that doesn't go on to socialism. And I think this issue of whether there is a transition stage is very key, and we MHI doesn't think there is. That's what Andrew was talking about in his pieces, that you can't be a little bit socialist. You've either reached a stage of communism, it may not be full-fledged from each according to his ability, to each according his need, is obviously not around the corner because it requires so many changes. But if we've done away with the law of value, which compels workers to work the most they possibly can and get paid the least they can live on, we can have socialism in the sense that the amount of, in hours, the amount of work you do, you are compensated for in material goods. And that's, you know, Marx's lower phase of communism. Now that, I think Andrew mentioned, that has been so misrepresented as if it's not yet any kind of communism, as if it's only an interim stage. That has, Marx didn't say that, right? Why have people misrepresented that so much? I think it's because they don't know how to envision or deal with socialism. They've given up on the very idea of transforming society. And I think that's our main problem in talking to people these days. They just think it's impossible, so their minds can't even get around what Marx was describing. I was going to say some things about Ferretti, but I'm not going to bother. I found him like really weak. Sometimes I couldn't even tell what he was talking about. But keeping his eye always on sort of the mechanics of the market, the labor market, in particular distribution, and not putting his eyes on what was going on with the workers, is certainly, as one or more of you have said, was key. So, Donevskaya read and reinterpreted Capital. She did it like, I think, at least once a year she'd reread the whole thing. Because it's not because she was wrong earlier. It's because new things pop out at you. New things have significance with a change of circumstances. So she was certainly able to improve empirically when she got the statistics, you know, that the workers' conditions had worsened rather than improved. So, of course, she was saying, oh, this couldn't possibly be socialism, but that compelled her to think a lot about what it was. So it wasn't because she found the answer per se in Capital, although she did find the characteristics of capitalism that applied so well in the Soviet Union. But it was because she was looking without preconceptions about what had happened, and I think that's a real barrier now, 70 years later, because everyone has this misconception that the Soviet Union was socialism. It blows my mind that 25 years after the thing dissolved, people are still stuck in the characteristics that she pointed out way back in the 40s, that the supposed planning and nationalization of property define socialism. And somehow we have to be able to get people to see that's not it if we're going to get to first base with them. But I think we also have to get them to see what state capitalism is, because without that concept, it's very, very hard to see what the difference is between any current or recent society and a socialist society in which the workers control production and distribution and everything else. It's just such another world. Over. Who else? Wait, we got to deal with the time problem. It's now 10 to 12. And we said we'd stop 15 minutes before the end. Now, we lost some time with the technical problems. So let me ask, do people want to extend 15 minutes so that we can have 10 more minutes of discussion?
Yes, please.
Is there anyone who cannot stay until a quarter after? Okay. Then let me see if anyone else would like the floor under this discussion for 10 more minutes. Andrew would. All right.
Yeah, on what Nigel said, I mean, I think that the workers taking direct control of the means of production is absolutely necessary and a good first step, but it's only a first step. I mean, we had sit-down strikes, occupations
seizure of factories in 1936-37 in this country that created the big labor federation, the CIO. But what happened is the workers would seize a factory, and then they call up the union, and they go, they weren't unionized. They go, okay, so we just took over the factory. What do we do now? They didn't know what to do. You know, and so they alienated their power in the hands of the union bureaucrats, and the rest is history. So, I mean, what is needed is clearly to figure out, look, if there is a specifically capitalist mode of production, then it's not only a question of who is in control, so to speak, of the mode of production, because the mode of production is really in control and they're just, you know, personifications of the mode of production. So the real question is to get rid of the capitalist mode of production, and that requires getting rid of value and value production and making labor directly social, and nobody has the all the answers at this point. But in regard to what Osling said, yeah, I mean, it's going to have to be a planned economy. If it's not a market economy, the new society will be planned, and Marx is, absolutely certain about that. Whether it's centrally planned or not is a whole other question, but there's a difference between planning and, or so-called planning, which wasn't really even planning in the USSR, and planning, by a free society, classless society. I mean, there are just so many differences there. I don't have time to get into the whole question of transitions and stuff. Now, let me just say, with regard to what Anne said about Raya reading without preconceptions. Well, I don't really think so. I was trying to say that wasn't the case. I mean, this is what we're supposed to do. Open our eyes, be disinterested. I don't think it works. I don't know anybody who's ever accomplished anything by reading who reads that way. So, no, she was out to prove a point. Her preconception is that Russia was a state capitalist society, and she was out to prove it. At least according to the conceptions of capital. Now, what you might have meant is that she didn't have the preconceptions of the traditional interpretations. Well, she was actively reading against the grain. She was battling. She was very well aware of them. She was battling them. So I don't know how much these comments about reading are going to resonate with people, but I actually think they're important when I reflect upon what I do and what other people do. I think a certain awareness of what one is doing is helpful. But I don't know. Given Osling's comments in particular, I think we need to have a meeting that talks about the political transition period, the whole idea of a transitional society, and all that kind of thing, because it really is a topic unto itself.
Okay. I didn't say that she had no ideas in the back of her mind of what she was looking for. I meant that she didn't have a fixed preconception about everything she would find, and certainly she wasn't picking and choosing her quotes from Marx. I mean, either you're rooted in what the workers are doing and what their relation to each other and to the things are, or you don't, and I think that comes through very clearly in her writings. Anyway, let me see, does someone else is there anyone who has not spoken who would like the floor? Maybe everyone spoke. Is there anyone who would like to say something? OK. Okay, I don't hear anyone. So, Andrew, do you want to? Yes.
Yeah, it's Ravi. It's just that I think that any of the questions that come up in this discussion or any of the ones that we have, if you've still got questions, and this is particularly for Tim and Chris, or actually not, I'm mainly concerned about on this side of the pond, if you have any questions about things that we're discussing, we should continue it on the bulletin board that's set up. I know this is a future point, but the whole purpose is to try and we pursue things further than we can possibly do in a meeting of this nature, which would drag on for hours if we didn't call up for time at some point. But there's nothing stopping us from just posting stuff and having a permanent record of how the discussions have gone, which is what the bulletin board's meant to be.
Yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, I just want to say one more thing, kind of like to Tim. You know, I don't have a problem with the fact that you are struggling and you have problems. I was there myself. You know, I read Capital and all of this, and I thought that state capitalism was an oxymoron, you know, like jumbo shrimp or, you know, military justice or something. Like, how can it be state and capital? I mean, you know, and I had read every word of Capital and for myself and so forth and so on. All three volumes, all of this. And then, you know, I get confronted with Dunayevskaya's theory, and it took me a long, long, long time to work through the issues. And I was actually a member of her organization for 6 months until I finally, like, threw in the towel and said all my objections, you know, were basically wrong, and that she had gotten it right, you know. So it took a long while, and, you know, I know exactly what the sticky points tend to be and so forth, and, yeah, you got to work through them.